In the spring of 1803, with the simple stroke of a pen, the United States of America doubled in size. The young nation, then consisting of just 16 states, or roughly everything east of the Mississippi River, purchased the French-controlled territory of Louisiana, a largely uncharted tract of wilderness stretching from Canada all the way down to New Orleans. Over 800,000 square miles that, so far as the maps were concerned, remained a mystery. In order to figure out what they had just bought, President Thomas Jefferson sent out an expedition to explore the newly purchased territory, all the way west to the Pacific Ocean. And tasked with leading this endeavor, officially known as the Corps of Discovery, were Captains Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. All total, the Lewis and Clark expedition would travel some 8,000 miles, navigating their way up the Missouri River before turning west and crossing the Rocky Mountains. If everything went as planned, they'd locate an all-water route linking the Missouri to the West Coast, and return as national heroes. Sounds great in theory, but life has a way of, well, getting in the way. And besides, before the Corps of Discovery could even think about turning west, they would need to make it past the mighty Lakota, a tribe rumored to be both numerous and warlike. Who was Meriwether Lewis? How'd he and William Clark come to lead one of the most important explorations in all of United States history? How'd they choose the men who would accompany them? What sort of supplies would they bring along? What about that air gun? How many venereal diseases would they contract? And what exactly was their cure for said diseases? My name's Josh, and this is the Wild West Extravaganza. As I alluded to in the intro, by the dawn of the 19th century, the United States of America consisted of just 16 states, the 13 original colonies, along with Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee, basically just everything east of the Mississippi River. As far as the rest of North America goes, the British held claim to present-day Canada, and the Spanish pretty much everything else, other than the Pacific Northwest. Not only did Spain control Mexico, California, and most of what's now the southwestern United States, but also the territory of Louisiana. Over 500 million acres encompassing the modern-day states Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota, along with portions of Louisiana, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, North Dakota, Minnesota, and the majority of Montana and Wyoming. So yeah, quite a bit of land indeed. Now, this territory of Louisiana once upon a time belonged to France, but they lost it in 1763, following their defeat in the French and Indian War, also known as the Seven Years' War for any of you communists who may be listening. That being the case, even though Spain technically owned the territory of Louisiana, it was still mostly populated by the French, especially in places like New Orleans, St. Louis. Or I guess I should say more accurately, the centers of European trade in Louisiana territory were mostly occupied by the French. Important to note that the lion's share of this land only belonged to these various countries on paper. In fact, the interior of what's now the United States was dominated by a wide array of indigenous peoples and cultures, tribes who would, for the most part, continue to fiercely protect their land for decades to come. Now, although the French had pretty much been evicted from the continent following that ass-whooping they received during the war, they still hadn't forgotten about the New World entirely. Much like a jilted lover who begins texting you all of a sudden years after a breakup, France was still keen on getting Louisiana back. And truth is, they were successful. Partly due to Spain being in dire financial straits, they were pressured to trade the entirety of Louisiana back to France in exchange for a new territory on the Italian peninsula. Sounds like a pretty raw deal to me, but hey, I'm sure it made sense at the time. Unfortunately for France, they had bitten off a little more than they could chew. Not only had Napoleon recently lost over 10,000 troops in Haiti, but the drums of war were once again beginning to beat throughout Europe. As such, once the United States heard about Spain giving Louisiana back to France, they came offering to buy the port city of New Orleans for a cool 10 mil. Much to the American surprise, France then offered to sell the entire damn Louisiana territory for an extra 5, bringing the total to $15 million, or roughly 4 cents an acre. And holy shit, would I love to find some land for 4 cents an acre. Needless to say, U.S. officials jumped at the opportunity and the deal was finalized on April 30th, 1803. And yeah, just like that, the United States nearly doubled in size. stretching her western border from the Mississippi River Valley clear on to the Rocky Mountains. Still, though, like I said earlier, this was just on paper. Although Spain had indeed ceded Louisiana back to France, they weren't all that happy about these greasy Americans getting their hands on it, and in the years that followed, there would be many a boundary dispute, with some even going so far as saying that the entire Louisiana Purchase was illegal. You see, not only were the Spanish worried about a mass migration of Norte Americanos flooding into their former territory, but more than anything else, they were concerned about being cut out of the lucrative fur trade. I cannot stress how important of a commodity fur was back in the early 19th century. Long before we ever had railroad tycoons or oil barons, it was the fur trade that absolutely dominated North America's economy. Hell, the first American millionaire, John Jacob Astor, built his empire almost completely off of the buying and selling of fur. That and opium, but that's another story for another time. Suffice it to say, Louisiana Territory was extremely rich in fur. That sweet, sweet beaver. And although it now belonged to the United States, it was still incumbent upon the Americans to get in there and make their presence known, to stake their claim, so to speak, especially before their neighbors, Spain and England, got to having any funny ideas. That's where a little sum called the Corps of Discovery came into play, aka the Lewis and Clark Expedition. They were to explore this newly purchased territory, establish a good relationship with the natives, and above all else, hopefully, fingers crossed, find an all-water route that would link the eastern United States to the Pacific coast. To lead this venture, then-President Thomas Jefferson chose none other than his personal secretary, a young man by the curious name of Meriwether Lewis. Born in Virginia in 1774, Lewis's family was what Jefferson once described as distinguished. One of Meriwether's great uncles sat on the King's Council, and yet another had married the sister of George Washington. Even the family home where Meriwether grew up, a tobacco plantation known as Locust Hill, was just a stone's throw away from Jefferson's Monticello. That being the case, he and the future president would, in time, come to form an almost father and son-like bond. Speaking of fathers, sadly, Lewis's actual father would pass away from pneumonia when he was just 5 years old. And it wasn't long after that when his mother would remarry and the family went to live with Lewis's stepfather in Georgia. It's there where Meriwether would cultivate a love for the great outdoors, spending a good deal of time out in the woods hunting or just wandering, and even getting to know the local Cherokee. Also, thanks to his mother, Lewis gained an extensive knowledge of herbal remedies and the medicinal properties of various wild plants. He also grew up with an intense hatred of the British. Can't say as I blame him. According to a family friend, Lewis, quote, acquired in youth hardy habits and a firm constitution. He possessed in the highest degree self-possession of danger, end quote. I'm not really sure what that means, but I think what the guy was saying was that Lewis had the goods. At around the age of 13, Meriwether was sent back to Virginia to receive a proper gentleman's education, and then, just a few years later, he was able to legally take hold of his inheritance, his late father's estate there at Locust Hill, which consisted of 24 slaves and nearly 2,000 acres of tobacco fields. Still, though, I guess the life of an aristocrat didn't much appeal to young Meriwether. He joined up with the Virginia militia during the Whiskey Rebellion, and apparently he liked soldiering more than planting tobacco, as he would transfer to the regular army not long thereafter and work his way up to the rank of captain. Over the next few years, Lewis would mostly serve in the infantry, but by the spring of 1799, he was appointed as a regimental paymaster, a duty that would see Lewis spend quite a bit of time on what was then the frontier, in far-off exotic places like Ohio and Detroit. Now, although Lewis did garner one hell of a reputation as both a soldier and an officer, he was still prone to being somewhat of a hothead, and, let's be honest, a little thin-skinned. Also, didn't help matters none that he had developed a taste for liquor. Matter of fact, Meriwether would face a court-martial in 1795 after drunkenly challenging a fellow officer to a duel, a charge that he was later acquitted of, but still, the dude was not one to back down, especially after he had a few drinks under his belt. Now, speaking of Lewis's disposition, there was another trait, other than his love of booze, that, according to some, seemed to run in the family. Per Thomas Jefferson, Meriwether suffered from quote-unquote hypochondriac affections, or what we would now describe as depression. While this affliction doesn't seem to have slowed Lewis down much in his youth, it would come to greatly haunt him in his latter years. More on that in a bit, but for now, I want you to imagine that it's March 1801, and Thomas Jefferson has just been elected as the nation's third president. Remember, Jefferson and Lewis's family were neighbors in Virginia and went back quite a long ways. I failed to mention this earlier, but Meriwether's uncle on his dad's side, Nicholas Lewis, had even previously managed Jefferson's affairs while the future president was away in Paris. Be that as it may, it was not just this family acquaintance that caused Jefferson to recruit the then 26-year-old Captain Meriwether Lewis as his secretary. A lot of it, honestly, just came down to politics. Ugh, I always feel dirty even just saying that word. You see, Jefferson was a staunch anti-federalist, and the military, at the time of his election, was staffed by a majority of Federalist officers. Seeing as how one of his first goals as president was to reduce the size of the army, he, Jefferson, would need someone he could trust like Lewis, who also happened to have an intimate knowledge of the officer ranks. In other words, Meriwether's initial job was to help the president decide which officers got the proverbial axe. Now, whether or not Jefferson had already settled on Lewis to head west and recon the territory of Louisiana back in 1801 is unclear. What we do know is that Meriwether would spend the next 2 years living with and working in very close proximity to the president. And yeah, at some point in 1802, even before the big purchase, they would begin to hash out their plans to explore Louisiana. The expedition, like I said, officially known as the Corps of Discovery, would head up the Missouri River to present-day North Dakota and continue following it west to its source. From there, they would cross the Continental Divide, hopefully via water, and head down the Columbia River all the way to the coast. And I say via water because more than anything else, the chief mission of the Corps of Discovery was to locate an all-water route that would link the United States to the Pacific Ocean. This was a big deal. Not only would it be huge for commerce and solidify America's control over Louisiana, but let's be honest, who doesn't love to float the river, right? Nice sunny day, just lounging in an inner tube, bobbing up and down with the waves. Ice chest of cold beer floating next to you. Maybe some girls with questionable morals wearing next to nothing. With an all-water route to the West Coast, President Jefferson could literally float the river from the Atlantic all the way to the Pacific and not even have to get out to use the restroom. No. I honestly do not know if President Jefferson liked to go inner tubing. Truth is, an all-water route, in addition to being a boom for commerce and solidifying America's control of Louisiana, would also strengthen U.S. claims to the lands beyond, aka the Pacific Northwest, or what we now know as the states of Oregon and Washington. And yeah, there is an R in Washington. I guess back in those days, the theory was that the Missouri and Columbia Rivers were somehow connected, possibly by a large lake up in the Rocky Mountains. President Jefferson assumed that whoever controlled this hypothetical cross-continental river would also dominate trade and transportation throughout all of North America. In addition to all of this, the Corps of Discovery was to also establish friendly relations with the various indigenous tribes that they would encounter. Once again, this was mostly with commerce in mind. Remember what I said earlier about the fur trade. There was big money in beaver, and the United States was hoping to steal native trade away from the English. That said, Captain Lewis was to also learn and record as much as he could about these indigenous cultures, their languages and religions, relationships with other tribes, stuff like that. He was to inform them about the recent Louisiana purchase and convey the size and strength of the U.S. government, and hopefully even compel a few of their leaders to travel to Washington, D.C. and meet with Jefferson, maybe even do a little bit of river floating. Then there were the scientific aspects. Along the way, Lewis was to map the rivers, take careful observations of latitude and longitude, explore any and all new animal species, describe the flora and fauna and various minerals, and of course, ascertain what land was hospitable to farming. By the way, as far as my source material while researching this series, I did lean heavily on Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage. This is one of my absolute favorite nonfiction books of all time. If you're looking to go on a real deep dive of all things Lewis and Clark, I cannot recommend Undaunted Courage enough. Then there's the actual journals that were kept by the captains and a few of the other men. I have not read each and every entry into these man diaries, but I did consult them more than a few times. If you're interested, you can check the journals out for free at lewisandclarkjournals.unl.edu. Finally, if by the time we're done with this series, your itch has still not yet been scratched and you're hankering for some more Core of Discovery goodness, you'd be doing yourself a favor by checking out the Explorers podcast. Host Matt Breen does some excellent work, and I found his 8-part series on the expedition to be extremely thorough. Links to all of this down below in the show notes. Now, like I said, Lewis was already living with President Jefferson prior to the Louisiana Purchase, and they had even already began planning the expedition. Once the purchase was finalized, however, and Lewis was officially designated as the Corps of Discovery's leader, that's when the preparations really accelerated. For the better part of the next year, Lewis underwent a crash course in all things scientific, studying maps, geography, history, botany, cartography, a lot of other words that I don't really know what they mean. He had to learn how to use special tools like a sextant and octant, in addition to learning how to properly identify and label plants and animals with all them fancy Latin terms. And this would not be a solo venture. Joining Meriwether as a co-captain would be an old army buddy of his by the name of William Clark. And I say co-captain, but in reality, Clark was only given the official rank of first lieutenant. That said, as far as the men of the expedition were concerned, he was Captain Clark. Even Lewis addressed him by the rank of captain. For all intents and purposes, Lewis and Clark were co-commanders for the Corps of Discovery, and I'm not aware of any instance along the way where Lewis had to pull rank. The way these guys worked together, just seemingly without friction, it damn near borders on the unbelievable. But they did make it happen, Captain. Now, like I mentioned a moment ago, Lewis and Clark did serve together in the army, but not for very long, just for around 6 months. Matter of fact, at one point, Clark was Meriwether's commanding officer. Other than that, not much at all is really known about their early acquaintance, other than the two obviously making quite an impression on one another. Like Lewis, Clark originally hailed from Virginia. Born to a wealthy family of planters in 1770, William was the younger brother of famed general George Rogers Clark. The family would migrate to Kentucky around 1785, where William, much like his friend Meriwether Lewis, took to the backwoods of what was then the frontier. Ended up joining the militia in 1789 and fighting in the Northwest Indian Wars before moving to the regular army just a couple years later. By all accounts, William Clark was beyond competent as an officer, but his career in the military would sadly be cut short due to health reasons, what historians now think was most likely reoccurring bouts with malaria. That being the case, he resigned his commission in 1796 and headed back to his family's plantation outside of Louisville, which is where he was when Lewis recruited him to help lead the Corps of Discovery. And it really was a perfect pairing. Not only did Meriwether Lewis and William Clark have absolute trust in each other, but where one was weak, the other was strong, and vice versa. For instance, Clark was nowhere near as educated as Meriwether, but he was far superior when it came to water navigation and the practical experience of leading men in combat. Also, William's more even-keeled nature would help to balance Lewis's, shall we say, headstrong tendencies. With the leadership issue taken care of, all that was needed now was to secure the necessary supplies and the men to make the expedition a success. Now, their main vessel or mode of transportation, for at least part of the way, was a specially designed keelboat that Lewis had ordered built over in Pittsburgh, fabricated solely for the purpose of this expedition. That's K-E-E-L, keel boat. Had a few people question what I was trying to say on a previous episode. Now, this particular keelboat in question was 55 feet long, 8 feet wide at its widest point, with a flat bottom and a shallow draft, meaning that it could more easily navigate in shallow water. There was also a 32-foot-high mast, but as I'm sure you can likely imagine, it was going to take a whole hell of a lot more than wind to push this bad boy upriver against the current. Yeah, against the current. I think it's important to remember that these guys were going up the Missouri. Keep in mind that this was before the invention of steam-powered engines, and that keelboat would be loaded down with several tons of cargo. Sure, the sail would help if the wind happened to be blowing just right, but in all actuality, this vessel would need to be muscled up the river, either by rowing or using long poles which the men would shove along the river bottom. Or if neither one of these options were possible, they would literally walk along the shore and drag the boat upriver with tow lines. Make no mistake about it, the Corps of Discovery was to head up the Missouri by brute force and damn near brute force alone. In addition to the keelboat, there was also a couple of canoes or pirogues. Please do not email me saying that I'm pronouncing pirogue incorrectly, alright? I'm saying it the way that Hank Williams Sr. says it in Jambalaya on the Bayou. And if it's good enough for old Hank, then by God, it's good enough for me. P-Rogue. Now, that keel boat was not meant to complete the journey. Lewis knew that they would likely end up wintering with the Mandan up in present-day North Dakota, at which point the keel boat, along with several of the men and any scientific specimens they happened to gather, would be sent back downriver to St. Louis. The others, what they'd call the permanent members of the Corps of Discovery, would then continue west in the P-Rogues. As far as the necessary provisions, I think all total they'd be hauling somewhere around 10 tons worth. A partial list of supplies included 3,700 pounds of pork, 3,200 pounds of flour, nearly 2,000 pounds of hulled corn, 750 pounds of salt, 112 pounds of sugar, in case anyone had a sweet tooth, 100 pounds of lard, I think his name was Craig, 50 pounds of coffee, and close to 200 pounds of a little something they called portable soup, a thick paste made of boiled down beef, eggs, and vegetables. And I don't know about you, but I just threw up a little in my mouth. Apparently, this soup was not a fan favorite, and only used if no other means of sustenance were available. Goes without saying that all of these provisions would be heavily supplemented by wild game. Then you had the captain's various scientific and navigational tools. You know, a quadrant, sextants, a telescope, tape measures, stuff like that. Several reference books on everything from botany to mineralogy, and various writing utensils. Hell, I think Captain Lewis even had a small writing desk. Other tools included items like needles, awls, candles, handsaws, knives, pliers, hatchets, flint and steel for starting fires, several pounds of fishing hooks and tackle, files. They also had spare blankets and coats and wool pants, flannel shirts, even mosquito netting. For their arsenal, the men had over a dozen Model 1803 muzzle loaders, and just as many 1795 Springfield muskets, along with several hundred pounds of lead and gunpowder. There was a small cannon attached to the keel boat, along with several blunderbusses, and believe it or not, even an air rifle. Yeah, an air rifle. I assure you, however, that this was not your daddy's Red Ryder BB gun. The rifle in question was a Giardoni, first designed some 25 years prior by an Italian, and actually used in combat by the Austrian army. Which, in hindsight, may be why nobody has ever heard of the Austrian army. Just running around playing tag with a BB gun, I guess. No, I'm just being silly. And in fact, the Giardoni was deadly. It shot a 46 or 51 caliber ball at 500 feet per second, and was said to have been lethal up to 150 yards. Although, according to Captain Lewis, it was only accurate out to around 50. Not only that, but the Giardoni had a holding capacity of 20 balls. Once loaded and charged with air, all you had to do was cock that bad boy and pull the trigger. Essentially just a very early version of a repeating rifle. I've even heard of some describe the Giardoni as the first assault rifle. With all that said, though, it was not a very practical weapon. First of all, you had to fill it full of air with a hand pump. I think it took something like 1,500 pumps just to get the necessary air into the cast iron reservoir, which, as it turns out, was held in the butt of the rifle. In other words, if you weren't too careful, you'd bang a hole in the butt and spring a leak, thus rendering it useless. So yeah, while the air rifle was a possible means of defense, it was mostly used as a way for the Corps just to show off their technological superiority to the indigenous. Speaking of the indigenous, a lot of the supplies that the expedition would haul upriver were designated as trade items used to purchase goods and services from the natives. Mostly just a bunch of inexpensive trinkets, you know, scissors, thread, cloth, thimbles, knives, beads, pipe tomahawks, medallions, shit like that. The Corps of Discovery would also be hauling several barrels of whiskey upriver. This was back in the good old days when fighting men were given such necessary staples as part of their daily rations. As such, each member of the expedition was allowed a gill of whiskey each evening, equivalent to 4 ounces, or roughly about 2.5 shots per man. Not a bad reward after a hard day's work, but they could only justify packing so much, and they would end up running out about a quarter of the way through the expedition, after which they just had a raw dog reality. Welcome to my world. Now, Captain Lewis had considered bringing a physician along, but in the end, I guess he figured he and Clark could do any necessary doctoring. With injuries all but guaranteed, the captains laid in a generous supply of medical implements like lancets and forceps, syringes, tourniquets, salves for blisters, and various herbal remedies. Rounding out this portable hospital would be several hundred special pills obtained from Meriwether's medical advisor and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Dr. Benjamin Rush. These pills of his, often referred to simply as Rush's bilious pills, or by the men of the expedition as thunderclappers, were comprised mostly of calomel and jalap. In case you're not familiar, I certainly wasn't. Jalap is derived from a plant whose scientific name I cannot pronounce, and it was pretty much just used as a very powerful laxative, hence the nickname Thunderclapper. As far as the other active ingredient, calomel, well, that's just a nice way of saying mercury.
But Josh, mercury is poisonous!
Yeah, no shit, even in small doses. Sadly, this was not known back in the early 19th century, and mercury was a common treatment for everything from the yellow fever to insanity, and even syphilis all the way up to the invention of penicillin. As far as the Corps of Discovery was concerned, Lewis would prescribe these pills for damn near everything, especially syphilis. That's what they don't teach you in history class. As it turns out, the men of the expedition were riddled with STDs, and the mercury treatment might explain why so many of them would end up dying fairly young. Unless you think that they were only occasionally taking small doses, experts have been able to pinpoint the location of certain Corps of Discovery campsites due to the amount of mercury still found in old latrine pits. Now, I keep bringing up the men, so let's talk about them. Like I said, not everybody would be along for the entire journey or considered quote-unquote permanent members of the expedition. Obviously, you had the captains, Lewis and Clark, at the helm. Joining Clark would be his slave, a rather large black man known only as York, and accompanying Lewis would be a Newfoundland dog named Seaman, which he purchased back in Pittsburgh. That's S-E-A-M-E-N, okay? So get your mind out of the gutter. Lewis's dog was not named after the love batter that comes out your wee-wee during sexy time. Why don't you try growing up a little? We've got some serious topics to discuss, and I can't be stopping every 5 minutes for your juvenile jokes. Now, it was also in Pittsburgh where, according to Stephen Ambrose, that Lewis recruited John Coulter and George Shannon. Shannon, by the way, at just 18 years of age, would be the youngest member of the Corps of Discovery. And Coulter, well, I got a lot more to say about him later on at the end of this series. Meanwhile, in Louisville, Clark was busy recruiting as well. Men like Charles Floyd, Nathaniel Pryor, William Bratton, Reuben and Joseph Field, George Gibson, John Shields, and others. Now, many of these guys that I just named were civilian volunteers, but others, like Sergeant John Ordway, were already in the military and pulled from active duty. They were still volunteers too, mind you, and every man, one of them, soldier and civilian alike, desperately wanted to be part of this expedition. And on that account, they certainly were not alone. Soon as word got out, men from all over came a-flocking, hoping to be selected by the captains. That said, most were rejected due to the high standards. This was to be a long and dangerous trip, and its success hinged largely on selecting the right men. The steady sort who knew how to use a rifle, physically strong, and preferably with prior experience in the backcountry. One of the men, Alexander Willard, would later boast that his, quote, fine physique enabled him to pass the inspection for enlistment that more than 100 others failed, end quote. Now, the Corps of Discovery would have its official swearing in on the 31st of March, 1804. There were three sergeants, the aforementioned John Ordway, Charles Floyd, and Nathaniel Pryor. They, along with 22 privates, were the so-called permanent members, the ones designated to make the entire trip to the Pacific and back. Joining them would be the expedition's official interpreter, a guy by the name of George Drewer. Part French-Canadian and part Shawnee, Drewer was not only an experienced backwoodsman, but fluent in several native dialects, including sign. By the way, I'm relatively certain that I am not pronouncing his name 100% correctly. It is French, spelled D-R-O-U-I-L-L-A-R-D, and apparently the D is silent. I went back and forth on whether to use Drewer or Drewyar, so you may end up hearing a mixture of both during this series. The non-permanent members of the expedition consisted of Corporal Richard Worthington and six privates who would only go so far as the Mandan villages and then return to St. Louis with the keelboat. And finally, there were around a dozen or so French engages or voyageurs. These guys were designated as boatmen or pretty much just hired labor. And just like Worthington, they'd only travel as far as the Mandan villages before returning home. I'm getting ahead of myself, though. Just to ensure I'm not confusing anyone, myself included, let's just take a real quick look at the timeline of 1803. The Louisiana Purchase occurred on April 30th. Remember, Jefferson and Lewis had already begun planning the expedition prior to the purchase, and by July, Lewis was already in Pittsburgh seeing to the construction of that keelboat. As soon as it was finished in late August, Lewis would take it down the Ohio River to Clarksville, Indiana, just across the river from Louisville, where he links up with William Clark. They, along with several recruits, leave together on October 26, once again via the Ohio River, all the way to the Mississippi, which they then follow up to St. Louis. It's there at St. Louis where Meriwether would be dropped off as Clark and the others travel to their winter quarters at a place called Camp Dubois, arriving on December 12th. Now, Camp Dubois was about 25 miles upriver from St. Louis, where the town of Wood River, Illinois now stands, and directly across from where the Missouri River meets the mighty Mississippi. It's there where the Corps would spend the winter of 1803 and 1804, training and finalizing preparations under the leadership of Captain Clark, as Meriwether remained in St. Louis tying up loose ends. You know what they say about idle hands, though, right? I mean, there's only so much training and drilling and shooting practice that a man can do in one day. To once again quote the great Stephen Ambrose in his excellent book, Undaunted Courage, these young heroes were in great shape, strong as bulls, eager to get going, full of energy and testosterone, and bored. So they fought and drank and fought. End quote. There were a few issues with insubordination, but it was mostly just minor stuff. You know, men sneaking off to get drunk when they were supposed to be out hunting. Stuff like that. At one point, however, two of the recruits, John Coulter and John Shields, did threaten to kill Sergeant Ordway. Remember, although some of these men were civilians prior to volunteering, they were now under military command and thus subject to military discipline. And where they were headed, a lack of discipline could literally mean the difference between life and death. That being the case, both Coulter and Shields were placed on trial for mutiny, found guilty, and summarily executed via firing squad. Still not satisfied with the punishment, Captain Clark then had each man's head severed and placed on pikes outside of the main gate of Camp Dubois. Once the expedition got underway, these heads would decorate the front of two of the pirogues. Shields' skull was lost somewhere over the Great Falls of the Missouri, but Coulter's would make it all the way to the West Coast and back. And it survives even to this day, although its exact location is unknown. Apparently, it was purchased by American businessman Samuel Prescott Bush sometime around the turn of the century, and his son, Prescott Sheldon Bush, grandfather to George W., would take it with him to Yale College in 1913, where, using Coulter's skull, he helped to found the secretive Skull and Bone Society. The Grizzly Trophy would go missing during World War II, but resurfaced in the 1970s at a museum in Copenhagen, of all places. Not long thereafter, it was bought by an unnamed collector, and so far as anyone knows, it is still out there somewhere. And no, absolutely none of that is true. Coulter and Shields would threaten to kill Sergeant John Ordway, but there is no record of either one of them being punished for doing so. They were indeed tried for mutiny, but according to the captains, Coulter and Shields did ask for forgiveness and promised to do better in the future, and I guess that was enough. Others would not be so lucky once the expedition got underway. Speaking of which, the big event came on May 21st, 1804. A week earlier, Clark and the others had met up with Captain Lewis at St. Charles, Missouri, and it's there where they departed, bound for the great unknown. No sooner had the oars hit the water when Private William Bratton jokingly asked, "Are we there yet?" The men all chuckled as Captain Lewis put on a mixtape he had compiled special for the expedition, consisting mostly of songs like Life is a Highway, Willie Nelson's On the Road Again, Bohemian Rhapsody, and of course the classic, I Will Sell My Vessel by Garth Brooks. And no, I did also make that up. I don't think any of those songs existed in 1804. But can you imagine just how annoying that would be? Also, I got to imagine that at least one of the men was trying to play whatever the 19th century version of Slug Bug was, for the others threatened to throw his ass overboard. And those French bowmen were for sure singing, Alouette, jante, alouette, alouette, jante, plomeré. No wonder they got sent home early. Hey, I want to tell you about American Criminal, a brand spanking new true crime history podcast from the same studio that brought you hits like American Scandal and American History Tellers. Hosted by Jeremy Schwartz, whose voice I am extremely jealous of, each weekly episode explores the dark side to the American dream. With American Criminal, you'll get inside the minds of the criminals and their victims, while also learning the historical context behind the crimes. The first two seasons cover two of the 20th century's most recognizable criminal stories. Remember brothers Lyle and Eric Menendez? How they killed their own parents for a multi-million dollar inheritance? Or at least that's according to the prosecutors in the press. And if that ain't enough to scratch that true crime itch of yours, we got Al Capone. That's right, the Al Capone. Let's just say they don't serve gabagool in Alcatraz. Capiche? Listen, American Criminal covers pretty much every kind of criminal you can imagine. The Salt Lake City bombings, Georgia Tan, the thief who stole babies, even more recent criminals like Sam Bankman-Fried, plus many, many more. Follow American Criminal wherever you're listening now. Or to get early ad-free access, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcasts, subscribe to Into History at IntoHistory.com. Now, just a moment ago, I mentioned that the expedition was heading into the great unknown, but that's not exactly accurate. I do think this is worth discussing because there seems to be two prevailing and contradictory narratives. One is that Lewis and Clark were the first people to ever see or travel over any of the land they ended up traversing on their way to the Pacific. The other is that the area had already been extensively explored prior to the expedition, and that the core of discovery didn't really accomplish much of anything as far as discovery goes. As always, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. First of all, I do think this goes without saying, but there were hundreds of thousands of Native Americans who called the territory of Louisiana home. They and their ancestors were, without a doubt, the first to discover mountain passes and rivers and other landmarks. They knew about the wonders of the Great Falls and Yellowstone and Yosemite for thousands of years before Europeans ever dreamed of showing up. As you'll soon hear, if it wasn't for the knowledge possessed by these tribes, and in many cases the help they provided, there is a very good chance that the entire expedition would have been a failure. Oh, and by the way, by the time the Corps of Discovery began, there were Native Americans living along the Missouri River and there on the Great Plains who had already traveled to Europe and back. In many ways, they had traveled more extensively and experienced more culture and refinery than either one of the learned captains. Now, as far as what the rest of the world knew, thanks to James Cook and his 1780 voyage, there was a pretty decent idea as to the overall size of North America. Also, the Columbia River had been somewhat explored as recently as 1792 by American merchant Robert Gray. No relation to Christian Gray. By 1803, it was just the interior of North America that remained a huge blank spot on the map. And even then, some of these blank spots were filled in prior to the Corps of Discovery taking off in 1804. Remember, the Spanish had explorers as well. Then there was the French and Bloody British up there in the frozen wastelands of Canada, slowly working their way down south. Hell, the Varandry brothers out of Quebec were most likely the first ever Europeans to see the Rocky Mountains. And that was back in the 1740s, in present-day Wyoming, 6 decades before Lewis and Clark. In the years that followed, many a Canadian fur trader had ventured on past the Great Lakes and into the Dakotas, while still others made a similar trip north up the Missouri. That being the case, the Corps of Discovery would encounter white traders living among several tribes along the Missouri River in the fall of 1804, some of whom had already been as far west as the Black Hills. Furthermore, thanks to these traders, before even setting off from St. Charles, the captains already knew that they would encounter the Lakota and Hidatsa and the Mandan further upriver. And it was from the Mandan and Hidatsa that they learned about what lay before them in present-day Montana. You know, the falls of the Missouri and the Rockies and other tribes like the Assiniboine and Shoshone. So yeah, Lewis and Clark weren't exactly starting this journey blind. Even the Rocky Mountains had already been crossed by Europeans, albeit much further to the north. Back in the early 1790s, a British explorer by the name of Alexander Mackenzie had traveled from northern Alberta west across the divide all the way to the Pacific in present-day British Columbia. And full disclosure, this wasn't even the first time that the United States had attempted such a venture. I didn't learn about this until very recently. Shout out to the Meat Eater podcast for this little tidbit. But in 1786, the Connecticut-born John Ledyard, at the urgings of Thomas Jefferson, attempted to travel from Russia to the Pacific Northwest, sort of a back-asswards version of the Lewis and Clark expedition. The idea was that Ledyard would cross over to Alaska from Russia and then work his way down the coast to the Columbia River, after which he would cross the Rockies and from there follow the Missouri down to St. Louis. Sadly, he'd be arrested by the Russians and deported before making it out of Moscow. A few years later, in 1790, then Secretary of War Henry Knox ordered John Armstrong to head up the Missouri all the way to its source, and while there, explore its southern branches. Unfortunately, due to poor planning and a lack of adequate supplies, this secret expedition never made it further than St. Louis. Then, just 2 years later, Thomas Jefferson was planning on sending botanist André Michaux up the Missouri with similar goals. Much like with Armstrong, however, this venture ended up dead on the vine before it even started. I don't really know all the particulars, but if I'm not mistaken, Michaux ended up being a damn French spy. So yeah, Lewis and Clark were certainly not the first people to attempt such a feat, nor would they be the first white people to ever cross the Rockies or to even set foot in the Pacific Northwest. That said, they were the first in many other aspects. They did make significant scientific discoveries. They were the first contact for more than a few tribes, and they really did blaze a trail that, in my opinion, helped open up the rest of the American West for everyone else. In a lot of ways, I do consider the Lewis and Clark expedition to be the genesis of the so-called Wild West. I mean, this was decades before guys like Jim Bridger or Hugh Glass or Jed Smith. And after nearly 8,000 miles across a mostly uncharted territory, many of those aforementioned blank spots on the map were indeed filled in thanks to the Corps of Discovery. Also, they weren't even back in St. Louis before the first trickle of American fur trappers began following in their wake. And by the way, just because there were certain things, air quotes, known about these western lands and their inhabitants, doesn't necessarily mean that the information was accurate. For instance, earlier, I mentioned how Mackenzie had crossed the Rockies some three decades prior. Well, it just so happens that the area he crossed was relatively low, just around 3,000 feet. This gave many people, Jefferson and Meriwether Lewis included, the false idea that the Rockies were around the same size as the Appalachian Mountains. In truth, when it came time for the Corps of Discovery to first cross the Continental Divide, they would do so at an elevation of over 5,000 feet. And then, no sooner were they across, that they came face to face with the Bitterroot Mountains. And let's not forget about the woolly mammoths. Although not a total and complete mystery, so little was known about these western lands that President Jefferson thought that the men of the expedition might just encounter giant mastodons. He also thought they would possibly bump into the lost tribe of Israel and that the Mandan were descended from the Welsh. I shit you not. And Jefferson was not alone with these ideas. Dr. Rush, the guy that provided Lewis with those mercury pills, also gave him an extensive and, in my opinion, intrusive list of things to study when it came to the natives. Everything from their rest and pulse rate to what age females began menstruating, and even whether or not any of their religious ceremonies resembled those of the Jewish people. Why they thought that there was a lost tribe of Israel out west, I do not know, but apparently this was a commonly held belief. So yeah, while there were certain things that were known about the territory of Louisiana, there was also quite a bit of mystery. Of course, like I mentioned earlier, none of that amounted to a hill of beans if they couldn't get past the Great Sioux Nation without losing their scalps. Word had it that the Lakota were not only numerous along the river, but hostile to boot, what some had already taken to calling the Pirates of the Missouri. They were for sure going to demand a toll for crossing through their territory. That much was a given. Only question was, would Captains Lewis and Clark be able to afford it? And I think that's where we're going to go ahead and wrap up today's story. Sorry for this delay between episodes. I originally was just going to cover John Coulter, and that turned into me doing an entire series on the Lewis and Clark expedition. I think all total this is going to end up being 5 episodes. So please join me next week, and we will continue our journey. Till then, head on over to WildWestExtra.com. For more true tales from the wild and woolly west. While you're there, hit that contact button. Let me know what's on your mind. That's wildwestextra.com. Or available wherever you get your podcasts. Except for SoundCloud, because I'm a grown man and not a 17-year-old mumble rapper. Alright, till next week, adios. Beaver.